The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrud from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. I'm Kurt Benrud, and this is titled, And for My Next Trek, by Robert Ballantyne, Jr. The rooftop terrace where Anton awaited his lunch jutted precipitously out over the Vegas Strip. When viewed from the street below, this gave one the impression that the building was in a deep yaw to starboard. During the night, the dappled pink and purple neon lights overpowered the stars, but in the sun-soaked Nevada day, the neons were likewise swallowed by the churning fusion reactor some 93 million miles above. A million tourists were, or would soon be, awakening from their post-revelry slumber. Anton leaned back in his chair and sipped at a Pama Granarita, a phonetically clumsy portmanteau of a remarkably refreshing drink, once you got past the flotilla of tiny umbrellas in the glass. Anton pinched one of the mini parasols between his thumb and forefinger and spun it with a flick. It tumbled listlessly toward the ground, causing him to frown. "I want you to rise." The umbrella changed course, gained altitude, and flew over the balcony railing, a papier-mâché ballerina pirouetting its way to the street. Anton followed it with his gaze until it passed a large billboard figure holding a black top hat and wearing a tuxedo. He smirked at his oversized likeness for a time before deciding that its teeth needed whitening. Instantly, his multi-story grin brightened and shone with a cartoonish, star-shaped sparkle on one tooth. This latter addition vanished when he decided it was too campy. In the haze beyond the billboard, a single red light blinked merrily atop a replica Eiffel Tower. Anton strained, stretching out his will to grasp at the electrics, but the lights continued to flicker, unperturbed by his efforts. Too far away. "Mr. Marvello, can I have your autograph?" Anton turned to find a small girl standing sheepishly a few feet away, holding a blue spiral notebook adorned with frolicking unicorns. In her pale white hand, she held a comically large pen with a shower of pastel tassels protruding from one end. Her cheeks flushed pink as their gaze met, and she looked down at her shoes. Some distance behind her stood a gaunt, equally pale woman holding a child's backpack. She chewed at her collagen-injected lower lip and clutched at the string of pearls around her neck. Anton motioned the girl over, and the woman's shoulders relaxed. "How old are you, little one?" Anton asked. 6, the little girl muttered, still apprehensive. She held out her notebook in front of her, a shield against an uncomfortable interaction. The unicorns on the front cover were decorated with multicolored crayon wings. Across their eyes were hand-drawn black patches that Anton supposed were meant to be sunglasses. "Would you like me to sign your notebook?" The girl nodded, shield lowering marginally. "What is your name?" "Alice," she answered, softly chewing on the tip of one finger. Anton took the pen and thumbed past dozens of crude drawings and sketches of fantastical beasts with misspelled block-letter descriptions, ultimately finding a blank page midway through the jotter. His magician's signature was a point of particular pride. Even before he was famous, Anton had spent long hours in his single-room apartment in front of a mirror, practicing a technique that was equal parts function and flourish. He showcased this now, signing, "To Alice, with love, the magnificent, magnanimous Mr. Marvolo." Beside his autograph, he sketched himself and Alice riding a winged unicorn. He motioned the girl closer and revealed the drawing, the page visible only to the two of them. The unicorn drawing reared up on the page, pen figures waving their arms in greeting. Alice giggled. Anton touched the page with a single finger, and the drawing froze. Unicorn and Riders Fixed in Eternal Greeting. For you, my darling. Thank you for being my biggest little fan, he said, handing Alice the notebook. Thank you so much for understanding, Mr. Marvolo, Alice's mother interjected, joining her daughter tableside. She, well, really, we are such big fans of yours. It's no problem, Anton responded, showman's smile ablaze. I always adore meeting enthusiastic young people. That trick, the one where you drove a car into a mirror on stage, then looked back out at the crowd, was just amazing. My husband and I went back to see it 3 times, and we just couldn't believe it. So amazing. So marvelous, Anton corrected, bowing his head slightly. Thank you. I worked very hard on that one. The woman paused, hand to pearls again. These clattered nervously between her fingers. I don't suppose you could give me a hint about how you did it, could you? He gave her a sly smile and a wink. Trade secret, I'm afraid. The woman's cheeks blossomed in a ripe red, and the duo backed away, mother giving something between a genuflect and a curtsy to mark their retreat. Anton ran his hand under his lapel, feeling the outline of the thin oblong device taped to his chest. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. He chuckled at the thought. There were times when he had pangs of guilt for not saving the alien that handed it to him. But these were usually assuaged by a glance down at his tailored suit, manicured nails, and Piaget watch. He was the hottest act in Vegas now, and the world was soon to follow. This certainly beat kids' birthday parties and nursing home shows. What did the creature expect? You couldn't hand someone a device that granted them virtually unlimited control over reality and realistically think they could risk its temptations. Of course, the alien offered its obligatory warnings, made more dire by its imminent demise and all. For emergencies only, dangers untold, that sort of thing. Anton was most dubious of the alien's claim that a star winked out with each use. But so what if it did? There were a billion trillion of them in the observable universe. He googled it. Some 300 million in the Milky Way alone. Enough stars for 1,000,000,000 lifetimes of use. It wasn't like you could see the stars in Vegas anyway. The lights made sure of that. Sir, your lunch is ready. The waitress placed a sizzling plate of beurre blanc steak and lobster in front of him. Anton closed his eyes and inhaled. Steaming butter and fresh cracked sea salt tickling the edges of his palate. Will there be any... A clattering noise interrupted his reverie, and Anton opened his eyes, catching the last bounces of a serving tray as it fluttered to a stop near his feet. He looked up at the server's face and noted how the neon lights reflected on the whites of her wide-open eyes, eyes that gleamed in stark contrast to the now coal-black afternoon sky. A cold wind blew in from the desert, rolling up and across the terrace, carrying with it the rising screams of 1,000,000 people. I'm Kurt Benrud, and this little piece is called Screen Time by Koji A. Dai. The protective foam case around the tablet is cracked, but its thickness makes the tablet easier for Grace's arthritic hands to grasp as she searches for the power button. The tablet is slow. It was an old model when she bought it for Stephen over 50 years ago. It's a miracle it still connects to the net at all. He's 3, she had told the shopkeeper. He doesn't need anything fancy. 3, the shopkeeper, barely out of his teens, smirked. Kids understand technology better than we do. Digital natives, right? He'll need an upgrade within a year. She had stood frozen with indecision between rows of tablets. experts had lifted restrictions on childhood screen time the previous year. Before that, too much tech was mentally and emotionally damaging. Now they expected her to embrace the next generation's technological fluency? No, just the basics. The shopkeeper was right, though. Stephen quickly grew frustrated with the device. He wanted something faster and with more features. His discarded tablet became Grace's backup device. She'd never needed much. The screen comes to life with a familiar chime. There's Stephen. Green light. Always online. She taps his avatar. Mama! He wears his 6-year-old smile. 6 had been a lovely year, full of hugs and garden slugs. But the face on the screen is wrong. A bit around the ears, a twitch of the lips. Only a mother would realize it isn't him. Can you change your face, dear? Years pass on the screen, and he settles into the body of a 20-year-old man, clean-shaven and optimistic. This better? How are you? It's been a long time. Time passes differently for Stephen. He explained it once. A day was an eternity, but an eternity was no more than a second. It was too confusing for her to understand. The doctors say I'm not well. I'll be passing on soon. No, Mama. Come here instead. She runs her finger over his face, never aging past 26. He had been in the first wave when the technology was still uncertain. Those trusting digital natives. It's not right for a human to live forever. Isn't that what you think your soul does? You'll leave your body, but your soul will carry on? It's what I hope. He sighs and shakes his head, actions carefully curated for her understanding. You wouldn't be lonely here, Mama. You'd be connected to every mind. Not every mind. Not yet. There are still a few of them living in rotting bodies, speaking with slurring mouths, and loving with warm-blooded bodies. His lips tremble. You'll be connected to me. Could I hold you and know for certain it was you, really you, in my arms? His face falls, flashing back a few years before stabilizing. Well, no. The aching in her arms can be mistaken for arthritis, but it started as soon as Stephen left. Now, finally, she can find relief. I just wanted to say goodbye, my love. She cradles his old tablet, missing the body she created. As her eyes close, the image on the screen reverts to the 6-year-old boy, tears wet on his digital face. I'm Kurt Benroot, and this piece is called Thank You for Your Service by Steve Zissen. So I drag myself to this all-night store, one I don't usually go to, and the guy behind the glass wants to thank me and all. Thank me for what? He checks the monitor above him. You know, your service. All I wanted was to zip in here and pick up an emergency pack of Night End. On account of my regular delivery, which comes right to my place, isn't showing up for another week or so. I guess I lost a couple of Night Ends in the couch cushions. But this guy is slowing me down, wanting and needing to thank me and all. He can't stand the silence that I haven't answered him, so he repeats his thanks, only with a longer sentence. I just want to thank you for your service. It's not like I'm going around wearing my medals. I'm not even in uniform. This hoodie doesn't qualify at all as a uniform. So how does he know? I flash my script at him. Where did you serve? I can't answer. It's none of his business. I don't want to answer that I was out at the Freedom Zone. I don't want to get into it. I went out there, war year 1040, 40 years past the current thousand-year war. I'm sure he didn't want to serve, that he didn't serve out beyond Mars with us. We're all volunteer. He just wants to feel part of it, like he's doing his crucial part of the Earth's survival by thanking me. The door opens, and the readout above it says 3:14 a.m. Another guy shuffles in. He's not wearing the uniform either. His arrival gets us moving. Finally, I still haven't said anything to him, but he slides the night end under the glass. Once I pay him, I ask, "How did you know?" He nods and says, "You troops back home are always running out of night end. I'm happy to do my part. Again, thank you for your service." I grab my night end package. "Thanks," I say, and start to leave. The nights never end out there. Or back here. I'm sure that's what he wanted to hear. I'm Kurt Benrud, and this piece is called Eight Characters by Anya Yao. "It's time," the nurse said. A digital countdown leaped over the wall. 099, 098. Countdown to the perfect hour. She had been sweating into her pristine white and blue uniform for an hour before this, getting ready. With her round face tightly masked, her envy was visible only as bruises within her eyes. 088. The surgeon's arms were sheathed in state-of-the-art bionics. The mods could probably complete the operation even if their host body was unconscious, but they were set on manual today. The life of the mother wasn't what was at stake. The future auspices of the baby were in their hands. The surgeon would have to time the procedure exquisitely to pull the baby out into the right hour of the right day of the right week, month, year. 072. In a talk show a quarter of the world away, the feng shui master smiled as he was asked a question about the births. "Well," he said, careful to look into the camera, "the world needs saving. We can all agree on that, can't we?" "What do you mean?" "I'm a Buddhist, but the will to survive crosses religion and faith. What I call the hour of the Messiah is coming, or has come, depending on where in the world you are. People born into the hour will be the luckiest children ever born." "According to the, what's it called, eight characters?" "The Shen Bazi, yes, the birth chart. It's part of an ancient astrological concept." "All the kids born into the hour will be messiahs?" No, they'd have the potential. It's a special dragon year, you know." "What happens if they all become messiahs?" "What's wrong with that?" 062. The mother smiled dreamily to herself. As far as she was concerned, she had already done her part as a mother and as a citizen. Labor was too risky to time perfectly. She'd elected for surgery. Her child would be born lucky, even if the surgery had to be rushed. Her mother and the mothers before her had always sacrificed everything for their children, before and after birth. This was just the newest rethread of an old story. 051. "It's nearly time," the grandmother said. The matriarch of the family clustered in the waiting room. She had a watch over one wrinkled wrist, a relic of her years. Nobody but the old wore analog watches now. It was more a bracelet than a watch, studded with diamonds. She felt reluctantly proud that generations of wealth had taken her to this point. She was on the cusp of successfully buying the Messiah into her bloodline. She had not approved of her son's choice of wife before. Now, close to the dragon hour, she allowed herself to thaw a little. 048. The father was at work in the family business. There were deals to make, matters to oversee, board meetings to attend. The nurses had sent him a carefully posed photograph of his heavily pregnant wife in hospital clothes for the family records. That was enough for him, where the process was concerned. He had no interest in the blood-and-bone work of birth, and was glad that he wasn't expected to contribute. The deal was signed with a flourish. "Congratulations," the new business partner said. "Any time now, right? Birth of the luckiest baby ever?" "Oh, that," said the father. "I don't believe in that kind of thing. Just something to please my mother. You know how old folks get." "021. There are about 4 births per second in the world. From this point in time, around 80 more children will fail to be born as the one. Luck is cruel, even in the presence of a formula. -118. The dragon child twisted in the arms of the doctor and let out a healthy wail. There were no further miracles. I'm Kurt Benrud. This is Virgilius the Sorcerer by Art Lasky. Virgilius the potter made pleasing plates and beautiful bowls. He made comely cups and the prettiest pitchers. But the artistic altitude achieved by his saucers was unmatched. Artists wept for joy at the sight of a Virgilius saucer. Competing potters wrecked their wheels and crushed their kilns upon seeing one of his creations. Wars were fought and ransoms paid for his saucers. Thus he came to be known from the tip of the Western Kingdom to the shores of the Eastern Isles as Virgilius the Sorcerer. Virgilius and his entire village thrived on the trade in his singular saucers. One day on the grassy common at the center of the village square, a sinister figure appeared, leaning on an ebony staff topped with a jagged crystal that pulsed with a malevolent, sanguine light, was Wargnoff, the Scourge, a dark sorcerer of foul repute.
"Bring me Virgilius the Sorcerer. Too often have I heard his name mentioned as the greatest sorcerer in the entire world."
Virgilius was summoned and tried to explain to Wargnoff that he was not a sorcerer, but a saucerer, a potter who makes saucers. Wargnoff would have none of it.
"Coward, I challenge you to a magical contest. The winner will be the greatest sorcerer ever known. The loser will be dead."
Virgilius realized that the dark sorcerer was beyond reason. Thinking quickly, he spoke. "Very well. Since you have challenged me, it is only right that I choose the contest. My greatest power is sleeping. I shall sleep for 100 years. Nothing will disturb me, and I will awaken without having aged a day."
"Then I shall sleep for 200 years, and awaken 1 year younger than I am today," proclaimed Wargnoff.
Both men immediately lay down on the sward. When Wargnoff began to snore, Virgilius rose with a triumphant smile and returned to his studio. From that day forward, he was known as Virgilius the Sorcerer's Saucerer.
And Wargnoff the Scourge became known as Wargnoff the Ivy-Covered.
We were goblins that summer, fire-roasted rabbit to eat and muddy pond water to drink, howling at the stars at night, groggy and green till afternoon. Cage and I hobbled everywhere during those sweltering days, dripping sweat down our youthful, twisted faces, long on ears, short on experience, smelling like gutted, discarded fish. We paid no never mind to the villagers, except to scare the occasional group of girls. That night by the flames of the bonfire, they were laughing. We appeared, prepped with our best pickup lines. One look, we stood, nothing more. They screamed and hugged each other. We kicked their ale, spit in their fire, and yelled and growled. Left, limped to other places. We hated their parents, the stories they told about us. But we loathed the prince in his big castle. Knights of glory, they said. Knights of cruelty to us. We are goblins, lonely, angry, avoiders of mirrors and pond reflections. Cage hit my face. I punched his stomach. Brothers, we talked like rocks rolling down the side of a mountain. Not home, but to eat tasteless soup, sleep in hay, and argue. Smoke in the air, rags on the dirt floor. I left. Cage stayed. I'm ugly, he said. Don't deserve no nothing. I traveled to the north, worked for a troll, collecting rotting animal carcasses for him to eat, a coin each. The next summer I didn't return, or the summer after that. Met a daughter of a werewolf, gorgeous to me, wild at night, skinny-dipped, raced through the forest together, laughed at many full moons together because she never grew fangs until two summers later. She changed on a blue moon, as daughter of werewolves do, and I changed, leaner, taller, cleaner. I returned home. Cage had moved out, but cared for our parents. He had changed and not changed, softer, slower, kinder, but still smelly, a drinker of muddy pond water and a teller of tall tales, but kept his laugh that warmed my heart. Met one of the bonfire girls by a wishing well. She didn't run from me, having experienced her own thunderstorms. We had a child together, a little girl, cuter than a baby unicorn, more magical than a fairy. I will always be a goblin, of course, but I am comfortable in my own skin now.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.